This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's no way of saying what a human life is worth in dollars and cents, but that was the job my guest Kenneth Feinberg was faced with. In 2001, he was appointed by then Attorney General John Ashcroft to head the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund and oversee the distribution of about $7 billion to the surviving victims of the attacks and to the families of those who were killed. The fund, which was created by Congress, marked the first and only time that the federal government offered individuals large sums of money, tax-free, to compensate for a tragic loss. Feinberg had extensive experience as a mediator, resolving disputes between Fortune 500 companies and victims of faulty products, health hazards, fraud, and wrongdoing. Feinberg was also one of the three arbitrators selected to determine the fair market value of the original Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. Feinberg has written a new book about his experiences compensating the victims of September 11th. It's called What is Life Worth? So when you were appointed to be the master in charge of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, exactly what guidelines were you given to help you decide who should get what amount of money?
Very little. If you read the statute, it is very simple. It's one page. The Congress simply delegates to one person, the special master or the administrator, responsibility for designing the rules, administering the program, and authorizing awards. And other than a rather simple generic formula for calculating compensation in individual cases, Congress does not say one word about how it ought to be done, who should get the money, who should file the claim. All of that had to be created out of whole cloth by the special master.
Which was you.
That's right. I was appointed by the Attorney General, General Ashcroft.
So let's talk about some of the most difficult financial and ethical dilemmas that you faced in dividing up this money. First of all, how did you figure out whether you wanted to just divide it up equally among all the people who were eligible or figure out some kind of formula to figure out who gets more and who gets less?
The statute absolutely prohibited me from dividing up an amount of money and distributing it equally. The statute said that I must first calculate the economic loss suffered as a result of the death or injury of the victim. That guaranteed a process that would require me to give more to stockbrokers and bond traders and accountants than to policemen, firemen, members of the military, busboys, or waiters. I was prohibited by statute from equal distribution of awards.
How did you feel about that? Because it's basically placing a value on a life as wage earner, as opposed to placing a value on the life as a spouse, a child, a parent.
Well, you know, juries do it every day in every city and village in our country. Juries always award more damages to the stockbroker or the bond trader than the waiter or the busboy. It's not un-American. It's done every day. Nevertheless, asking one person to calculate different awards by looking into some murky crystal ball and then expecting the families to accept the notion that one family gets $1 million less than another family proved to be very, very controversial and divisive. That we were able to overcome this requirement, I think, is a tribute to the fund and a tribute to the success of the fund.
You held a lot of town meetings for the families who lost loved ones on September 11th. Was there a lot of fighting among the families about this very issue, about some families getting $1 million and others getting a lot less?
Absolutely. At the beginning of the fund, after all, the fund was created within weeks after 9/11, so emotions were particularly raw at the outset. Families would object vehemently to the notion that the value of one life was calculated to be worth more than the value of another. And despite every effort that I made to explain, look, Congress has spoken. This is the law. I can't change the law. It did not sit well with firemen widows or policemen widows who proclaimed, Mr. Feinberg, my husband died a hero. Why am I getting $1 million less than the accountant on the 103rd floor of the World Trade Center? Now, I tried to explain that the notion, the concept of economic loss is well ingrained in America, that this was sort of a substitute, this program, for the tort system, for suing. And in one sort of conceptual sense, it made a lot of sense. But you try telling that to families who have not yet even buried a lost loved one or had a lost loved one vaporized at the World Trade Center, and I must say, it did not sit well for many, many, many months.
What about figuring out a financial formula for compensating for the pain and suffering of the victims and of their families?
Well, the statute required that I add to economic loss the notion of pain and suffering and emotional distress. I realized very early in the program that I could not make distinctions in terms of pain and suffering and emotional distress, and I announced in the regulations everybody who's eligible for a death claim will receive the same amount, $250,000 for the death of the victim and $100,000 for each surviving spouse and dependent. That was it. And I think everybody agreed among the families that it made sense not to make such distinctions on grounds of heroism or on grounds of certain victims surviving longer in the World Trade Center than others. I simply said, I'm not Solomon. I can't make those distinctions. They're invidious. I won't do it. And I set out this basic one-size-fits-all formula.
And everybody seemed comfortable with that.
Well, they were all comfortable with the notion of similarity. They weren't very comfortable with 250,000 and 100,000. They thought, all of them thought, that the pain and suffering and emotional distress amount should be four or five times that. But I was unwilling to simply open the U.S. Treasury up to projected wishful amounts, million, 2 million, 3 million, that I would not do.
So what was the final formula for figuring out how much each survivor should get? There was a standard number for to compensate for pain and loss. And what was the formula you came up for compensating for the economic loss of a loved one?
Yes, there was a four-part formula. Part one, I had to calculate economic loss. I had to try in individual cases to predict what a victim would have earned had she or he survived. Second, I had to add to that number non-economic, the standard non-economic pain and suffering, emotional distress that I just spoke about. Then I was required, much to the chagrin of the families, by statute, to deduct from that gross award collateral sources of income, like life insurance. And finally, Congress, in its wisdom, decided, unsure of how the calculations would come out, Congress added a safety valve at the end that said, ultimately, the special master shall exercise his discretion in individual cases to assure justice. And that was basically the four-part statutory formula that I implemented.
Did people ask for special compensation in any cases? And if so, how did you deal with that?
People individually came to see me. I held over 900 individual hearings where families came in, usually claiming unique financial circumstances. And in many cases, I adjusted the awards to take into account these circumstances. And in other cases, I did not. But very important, I invited any individual family or injured victim to come and see me personally, to put a human face on this program and allow them to explain to me in this unique program why adjustments should be made. And I listened carefully and considered those requests and acted on most of them.
Well, what's an example of one of the stories that you were presented with that seemed to rise to the level of being worthy of an adjustment?
Oh, my goodness. The stories are as myriad as human nature. One surviving spouse came to see me and said, Mr. Feinberg, I do hope that you'll find it in your heart to provide a little bit more money. I lost my husband and the World Trade Center, and I have terminal cancer. And I have two little ones at home. And it's not really the death of just one. Soon it will be my death as well. And my children will be orphans. And can you not only give me a little bit more money, but can you expedite the award because I have limited time? That's just one example, heart-wrenching example. But there are hundreds and hundreds of examples.
Do you remember how you resolved the question of how much to compensate this woman who was dying of cancer, having just lost her husband?
Yes, the woman explained, here's what I need, laid out a bill of particulars as to financial concerns going forward for her children, and we examined that and drew some conclusions and increased the award.
Was she satisfied?
I don't think anybody who filed a claim and received a check was satisfied by this process. I think that's the wrong word to use.
I bet you're right.
I think she respected the mm-hmm. willingness of the federal government to come to her aid. But I tell people all the time, words like satisfied, justice, fairness, gratefulness, happiness, aren't adjectives that are very helpful in examining this program.
So what finally was the range of figures in the amount of money that was given to families as compensation?
This program spent $7 billion of the taxpayers' money. This was a public compensation program. There was no congressional appropriation. Congress basically delegated to one person whatever it costs to do this right. Authorize it out of general revenues, petty cash at the U.S. Treasury. The range of awards, the average award for a death claim, tax-free by statute, was about $2 million. The death claim awards ranged from a low of about $500,000 to a high of about $7.2 million paid to the family of a 33-year-old stockbroker who died, who was making $3 million a year. The physical injury claims averaged about $400,000, but some of the physical injury claims, and there weren't many physical injury claims on 9/11, you either got out of those buildings in planes or you didn't. But the really serious physical injury claims, burn victims, at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, we paid, in a few cases, over $8 million to people who survived with third-degree burns over 85% of their body. Came to see me.
So were you comfortable finally with the fact that the family of a stockbroker who was killed was going to get millions of dollars so that they could continue to live the wealthy lifestyle they were accustomed to, and the family of somebody who worked, say, as a maintenance worker in the World Trade Center was going to get a whole lot less?
Well, that's a very provocative question. First of all, I was never comfortable with dispensing any of these awards. Having said that, it's also important to remember that I exercised my discretion in a way so that high-end families, some of whom came in seeking, under the formula, economic loss, $20 or $30 million. I exercised my discretion and substantially brought down the ultimate award number, feeling that under the statute, Congress never wanted any family to get so much that they were going to be able to simply automatically continue a lifestyle with different homes, summer homes, cars in the garage, etc. So at the end of the day, I felt that what I had done was to implement congressional intent. and provide a degree of compensation where an individual family might criticize me or might object, but the award was so generous and so fair that I would withstand any such criticism. And I think ultimately the families realize that.
Well, we've talked a little bit about how you arrived at the formula for deciding how much money should be given to the families of victims of September 11th. Then you also had to decide who gets the money. What members of the family actually get the money? Or, you know, does somebody who was engaged get the money? Does a same-sex partner who wasn't legally married because they couldn't be get the money? So let's talk a little bit about that. What were the standards, if any, that you were given about how to decide who gets money?
Not one word in the statute about that. Not one. You can look at this statute all day and parse it line by line. You will not find one direction from Congress as to who should file the claim among family members and who should get the money, very substantial amounts of money, among competing family members. So this proved to be a major problem. Mr. Feinberg, I am a sister of the victim, my brother. My brother hated our other brother. Make sure I get the money and not the hated brother. Mr. Feinberg, I'm the fiancé of the victim. We were going to be married on October 11th. So, you should treat me as a spouse. I was going to be married in a month. Then I would ask the biological parents of the victim, what do you think about that argument? Oh, this marriage was never going to take place. My daughter told me that on September 10th, she was thinking of calling the whole thing off. Then I'd go back to the fiancé. What do you say to that? Is that right? Look, Mr. Feinberg, here's the wedding invitation, right here in the church that we were going to be married. On August 11th, the parents held a shower for me, for the victim, and said, we're not losing a daughter, we're gaining a son. I mean, outrageous, the fiancé would say. Now, what I tried to do is work these problems out. I tried to work them out and get everybody on the same page, and I was usually successful. But I must say, it was a very thorny problem with money of this magnitude trying to get families on the same page.
Did you respect same-sex partnerships in the same way that you would respect marriage when it appeared to you to be a committed relationship?
Well, I did. If the victim left a will, and in the will left the estate to a same-sex partner, I honored the will. Why wouldn't I? Of course I honored the victim's intention.
What if there wasn't a will? A lot of people didn't have wills.
Now, 80% didn't have wills. These masters of the universe in the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, didn't think they needed wills. 80% of people who didn't have wills, I was left with a dilemma. Now what do I do? Well, I did the only thing I think I could do. And that is, I followed the law of intestacy in each state of the victim's domicile. And that meant that same-sex partners and fiancés were not entitled by law in any of those states to a share of the award. But I managed, nevertheless, to sit down with would-be recipients of the award. And as I say, through force of argument, emotional, substantive, legal, etc., worked out most of the disputes.
You were appointed by John Ashcroft from an administration that does not support gay relationships, certainly not gay marriage. Did you get any flack from the Bush administration for compensating gay partners of victims?
Absolutely not. Not only did I get no flack, remember, I was relying on state law. This was not a federal decision I made in terms of who gets money, same-sex partners, fiancés. I'm looking to the state law of the victim if there's no will. Not only did I get no flack, but I must say, throughout the entire life of the program. Attorney General Ashcroft and the Bush administration were enormously supportive, as was Congress. If you want the best example I know of a truly bipartisan, non-political, apolitical public policy, this was it. I'm extremely grateful for the support that I received from the administration.
Why you? Why do you think that John Ashcroft, who was then Attorney General, chose you to head the Victim Compensation Fund?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons, and I have the highest admiration and respect for the Attorney General Ashcroft for his support of the program and how much he supported me personally. I'm in his debt, frankly.
Can I interrupt and just point out here that you were, years ago, you were an aide to Senator Kennedy, who was much too liberal for the taste of John Ashcroft, so it wasn't your political credentials that made you the choice. Go ahead.
Oh, to the contrary, it was my political credentials that got me the job, in part.
Oh.
As I say in the book, I think one reason that the administration was satisfied with me is because if the program failed, as many thought it would, and caused more divisiveness than hope and help, it could be laid at the feet of a political adversary or somebody with a political pedigree different from the administration. But I think the main reason I received this appointment is because I had, before 9/11, a good deal of experience in dealing with the design and implementation of mass disaster claims. And I think the administration realized that this was a program that required somebody with some expertise in how to deal with the deaths of thousands of people.
What are some of the ways that your own life has been changed by this experience of heading up the September 11th Victim Compensation Program?
Oh, my life will never be the same. Never be the same. That I'm sure of. I've taken my law firm, which was a very large firm, and after 9/11 just reduced it to bare bones minimum. I don't think I want to practice law the same way anymore after 9/11. I want to teach more. I taught last semester at Columbia Law School and the University of Pennsylvania. And I'm much more fatalistic, I think. I'm not sure I'll plan more than 2 weeks ahead for the rest of my life. People said goodbye on September 11th. It was a beautiful day, a sunny day, perfunctory goodbyes after breakfast. Never saw him again. Not even a body, vaporized at the World Trade Center. Horrible. And I think that one ought to be a little bit skeptical about planning too far ahead, because life doesn't work that way.
Has the meaning and relative value of money changed for you?
No, I don't think money has really anything to do with it in terms of my... sort of my experience, or at least the residual impact of the program on me personally.
Because the program was all about giving out money.
The program was all about giving out money, of course. And, people should understand that, money can't make anybody whole. It's a poor surrogate in that sense. But I try and remind people when they say, this was so un-American, that we just gave out money and we gave out different amounts. What happened to equal protection and egalitarianism and democracy? That's wrong. It's just wrong. This program reflected what the civil justice system does every day. If you fall off a ladder and you're a stockbroker, if you get hit by an automobile and you're a stockbroker, you will get more from a jury, money, than if you're a waiter who fell off the ladder or got hit by an automobile. Now, it may be that everybody should get the same amount of money under this program, and I thought that would be better, but it isn't un-American to say that this program worked the way it did. It was very, very American, I would argue.
I bet you have a will.
Everybody should have a will. One lesson from 9/11 is everybody should have a will and leave a record, a formal record, of how you want your estate allocated in the event of unforeseen tragedy.
Even if you don't have much of an estate.
Doesn't matter. One thing I learned about 9/11 fund, people would come in, and what was so important to many people when they came to see me was not the millions and the millions, but, Mr. Feinberg, I want my wife's locket. Mr. Feinberg, can you help me make sure that I can keep the wedding album? Mr. Feinberg, I want to play you a video of my son's bar mitzvah. Mr. Feinberg, I want you to look at all the medals that my son earned as a fireman before his death. It wasn't all about money. In fact, most of these hearings, amazingly, I learned, were an opportunity for families to just talk, just discuss the memory and the corroboration of that memory in the way of albums and medals and certificates and things like that.
Well, Kenneth Feinberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm very, very honored and pleased that you gave me this opportunity. Thank you very much, Terry.
Kenneth Feinberg headed the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. His new memoir is called What is Life Worth?